This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. The word awkward, what does it conjure? An awkward silence, a lack of confidence, embarrassment, clumsiness. Well, how about genuine? We're going to take a fresh look at awkwardness with the help of poet, essayist, and critic Mary Capello in this portion of the program. Mary Capello is the author of Awkward, A Detour. She calls the book part memoir, part cultural criticism, part philosophical meditation. In awkwardness, she finds an opportunity to explore what makes us uncomfortable, providing insight into our discomfort and perhaps leaving us with a glimpse of grace. Listeners, you can share your thoughts with us this afternoon with a telephone call. You can join our conversation with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Mary Capello is a professor of English at the University of Rhode Island. She has been the recipient of a Fulbright Fellowship to teach at the Gorky Literary Institute in Moscow. Awkward, A Detour is published by Bellevue Literary Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mary Capello, nice to talk with you. Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for hosting me, Celeste.
Oh, my pleasure. Early in the book, in a turn about the word precarious, you write about slapstick.
Oh, yes.
Choreographed awkwardness, you say. And here awkwardness delights us, and as you point out, it soothes us.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to us when we see Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton in those very awkward scenes in those silent films?
Well, let me first say that comment on the awkwardness of our medium, which I find really fascinating, that I can't see you and you can't see me.
Yeah.
But my cat is looking at me. She's got her eyes fixed on me, and I did want you to know that I dressed up for the occasion. But slapstick represents to me a sort of controlled awkwardness, where awkwardness gets translated into a form of high art and is, you know, closer than to sort of like a state of beauty, where we take the things that threaten us and that seem beyond our control, and through a sort of brilliant choreographing of a body like Charlie Chaplin's, that which frightens us suddenly takes on a new form that we can put at a distance as well at the same time that we identify with it, I suppose. And, you know, that's just a tremendous thing to experience through high comic art.
Mm.
I suppose the fact that it becomes a subject for high comic art suggests just how significantly, how central, how important it is to maybe our very sense of self, you know, of selfhood. One of the things that really surprised me when I started to follow awkwardness was the variety of human experiences that awkwardness impinges upon or finds itself inside of. You know, I don't know any word, really, that makes its way so insistently into so many different aspects of what it means to be human, from the physiological to the sociological, from the psychological to the scientific, if we think in terms of physics, even to the political. And so, you know, this is what compelled me about it, though certainly my route to awkwardness actually was very distinct. It did unfold inside of a very specific set of circumstances that that I was confronted with.
You want to talk about that, but before you do,
sure.
I hope you didn't put heels on for the interview.
I didn't. Well, I do have a nice pair of shoes on.
Oh, okay.
I don't think, you know, if we're going to rise to the occasion of talking about such important things, one needs to be properly dressed.
Yes, yes. Well, now talk about the situations.
There were many. And the route to the subject was circuitous for me, even though once I arrived at it, it seemed obvious and so essential a subject for our times. But you mentioned the Gorky Literary Institute, where I taught in the year 2001. Of course, it's important to note that I was there at 2001 because I was in Russia at the time of September 11th, and I was teaching at the Gorky Literary Institute on a Fulbright Fellowship. Thereafter, in 2002, I spent time in Italy where I was documenting the lives of new immigrants to Italy. I came back to the United States, casting about for a subject, a thread on which to string the pearls of my experience. And I had done so much thinking and seeing in unfamiliar locales, it sort of felt like it yielded a lifetime worth of books. But I only wanted to try to write one book out of those experiences. In the meantime, I was teaching a class at the University of Rhode Island that I called Immigrant Subjectivities and Documentary Discourses, in which we were trying to consider how immigrants document their lives over and against the way in which they are documented by the state. And at that time, I was teaching an extraordinarily beautiful film by Rainer Werner Fassbinder. It's entitled Ali, or Fear Eats the Soul. And it features the love affair that unfolds between a young Moroccan immigrant to Germany and a white cleaning woman who is many years his senior. And so here I'm watching this film, studying it with my students, and we're observing together the awkwardness of their embrace of these two characters and talking about, thinking about how much more real this relationship as Fassbinder had depicted it seemed to us than the seamless forms of embodiment that we see in conventional cinema. Now, at the same time that I was teaching this film and being made, thanks to Fassbinder, to think about awkwardness, I wanted to share with my students a letter that my immigrant grandfather, John Petracco, was an immigrant from Teano, Italy. He was a shoemaker, but he was also a writer. And his writing was a sort of the open secret in my family. He left behind many, many volumes, mostly of aphorisms, but of other sorts of writing too. And he left behind letters that he did not send. The idea of the unsent letter is perhaps for another conversation, but I wanted to share with my students one of my grandfather's unsent letters to me, something that he had addressed to me as a child, because I wanted to share with them this notion of the immigrant trace, or what the immigrant documents about himself over and against the ways in which the culture documents him. And I happened to be reading this letter, which was quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was recounting to me the fact that I was a little girl when he wrote it, and I had just talked to him, I guess, about my writing. I guess I was writing even at that young age, and I was recounting to him the story of Pinocchio, as though he didn't know that story, I guess. And it was a very beautiful letter in which he was giving me back that picture of myself. But I turned the letter over, and on the flip side of the letter were the words that my grandfather was teaching himself that day from the English dictionary. My grandfather kept the English dictionary at the center of the dining room table, and every day he opened the dictionary and taught himself new words. And the words that he was teaching himself that day were awkward, awe, and a while. And it was that moment that awkward sort of hailed me and asked me to follow it. It was very much a gift, both from Fassbinder and my grandfather. And once I had the word in front of me, I thought, this is the word I need, not just to bring into concert some of the trafficking with unfamiliarity that I experienced in two countries that are not my home countries at the time of, in fact, September 11th, but also because awkward seemed appropriate for coming to terms with what I would call dissociation. I felt dissociated when I returned to the United States following being abroad, but also in light of post-9/11, you know. And, you know, I remember hearing at the time that on the radio, in fact, I heard a psychologist talking about the fact that dissociation was replacing depression as the contemporary, you know, malaise of our times. And yet, I never heard anything more after that interview that I heard on the radio with the psychologist about dissociation, in spite of the fact that I think dissociation is truly pervasive, and as such, perhaps we need to investigate it more and find a language for it. So awkward had this personal resonance for me at the same time that I came to understand that it spoke to the times in which we live, insofar as our refusal, you know, to embrace awkwardness following September 11th, I would suggest, got us into trouble. The insistence that we embrace resolve, self-certainty and smugness. And I'm drawing here, of course, from the language of our president, George W. Bush, I think did not serve us well. And so, yes, both a personal resonance and a historical political resonance became rich and pertinent to me. And what happened at the same time was truly unpredictable, because once I started to follow this word, it took me into areas that I never thought I would be meditating on. Mm. Precociousness, stuttering, so many areas of human life and relationship that I didn't have a clue would be important to think through. I might note that when I say that I followed the word, I mean that in the sense that a favorite psychoanalytic writer means it. I like to read the work of a writer named J.B. Pontalis, who has, among many books, written a book called Windows. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press, and it's a series of fragments in which he meditates on the trope of the window. And in this book, he says, if you enter something as a language rather than a concept, you find it at once and needs to travel. And it won't allow you to come to the point, but to wander toward multiple points arrived at from multiple directions. And so, you know, that my book, I've called it a detour.
Right.
Because I really was not following awkward as a concept set in concrete that I was trying to describe. I really tried to let it lead me. And consequently, I like to think that I've generated a new literary form, not the short story, neither the memoir nor the novel, but something I call the detour.
The detour.
Yeah.
It is a collection of essays, though, and I think that genre is really a wonderful way to, get off the beaten path and find out where where you are and where you're headed by taking a detour.
Yes, well, thank you for noticing that, because the essay is a very, very rich moment right now that we're in where that genre is concerned. It's undergoing a beautiful definitional crisis, almost nearly a revolution. It's really wonderful to be working in the form right now.
It's at an awkward moment?
Just now? Or is it an awkward moment to be writing essays?
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess one could consider it that way, certainly.
Yeah.
When you say that it's a collection of essays, it has been described that way, but I really conceived it as a book-length essay.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I would like to say that one of the things that distinguishes this book from any other book that I've written is that it's meant to be read, it can be read in two different ways. It really can be read in parts. One needn't read the whole book. And I know, what writer is going to admit that they don't, you know, that they don't expect an audience to read an entire book? Well, this really is a book that someone can open and read sections and fragments. And in order to pause inside of those meditations, it really is an homage to the fragment, and in fact, you know, that brings me back to the importance of aphorism, what I love about aphorism, you know, the short, pithy saying, the one line, the one-liner that is not a slogan, but that is a poem. I love that aphorisms work somewhere between poetry and prose. And unlike slogans, they slow us down when they're doing their best work. So the book can be read that way, but it is also meant to yield a kind of pleasure, hopefully, for people who want to read the entire book. I put it together in such a way to mimic concentric circles, with the idea that the themes that run through the book return more volubly with more amplification the further that you get into the book. But again, it needn't be read that way in order for it to do the sort of work that I hope for it to do, which is to get us to think together more about the implications of this wholly pervasive state.
Hmm. Speaking of, going back to when you were talking about September 11th, mm-hmm. and then you mentioned Fassbinder and the film, mm-hmm. and the subtitle, Fear Eats the Soul, mm. What is the relationship? Is there a relationship between fear and awkwardness? Awkwardness and fear.
Definitely, most definitely. I think that when we resist awkwardness, when we want to shut it down, or when we put it in a place that that is, you know, other, it's always that which we want to avoid, that it's a sign that something about it, or something about it's attending certain kinds of relationships, is indicative of terror. Yes, of terror. I was thinking before talking to you about some of the things that might come up, and I was wondering whether or not to mention a sort of terrifying thing that happened to me this year, and that actually that I was helped by because of having written about awkwardness, and I think I will mention it because it's fairly significant, and because I always like to keep things in the realm of the real. You know, I am a poet, I am a sort of philosopher, and at the same time, you know, I don't want to risk abstraction. And so to bring this really into the most, I guess, the most real place I can would be to tell you that when my book came out, almost at the precise moment when my book came out, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And this happened, June 5th was the date of my diagnosis, and June 2007 was the date at which my book came into the public realm. And, you know, one would think, oh, how terrible. How terrible. You know, your book comes out, and at the same time, you get a diagnosis like this. But what I've discovered is that writing about awkwardness, having thought so much about awkwardness, really helped me to cope with so many of the awkwardnesses that one must face with a diagnosis like this, including some of them are obvious and some are less obvious. But things like the way in which getting a diagnosis like this tips a scale in a direction and really demands your total attention. So there's this tipping that happens. Mm. The fact that there are various possibilities for deformation and malformation and asymmetry, and the, you know, both because of what the disease has done to your body, but also because of what the treatment is going to do to your body. And it leaves me, as someone who's investigated awkwardness, with the question of whether my scars should be visible, whether that damage should be visible, or whether I should cover it over. It leaves me with the question of, I do a lot of thinking in the book about awkward solitude. And when one is confronted with this sort of diagnosis, you really are thrown back on yourself at the same time that love and support, of course, is utterly of the essence, but there's something to be said for that solitude. And I think about awkwardness helping me here because at the same time that, like anyone else, I want, of course, to heal quickly, and I have healed very quickly and beautifully. If I heal too quickly, it means forgetting something that I need to remember. This is where awkwardness enters in. Awkwardness insists that we not let things get covered over too quickly, that we keep that which is frightening open. And I think that if I can do that, maybe it will help me to remember things that I need to remember, not only for myself, but for other people. So I hope that that helps to offer a sense of your question of the relationship between terror and awkwardness.
Yeah. Well, awkwardness requires recognition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely. The recognition of awkwardness can put us on course to pursue gracefulness.
Oh, that's really lovely. I do think that they needn't be opposed, and awkwardness needn't be understood as the opposite of grace, but as the route that one might need to take toward grace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That detour.
Yes.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is poet, essayist, and critic Mary Capello. We're talking with her about Awkward, A Detour. This is a book that she has written. She calls the book part memoir, part cultural criticism, part philosophical meditation. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. We welcome your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. And on our website, will.illinois.edu, when you go to the Afternoon Magazine and you look up today's program, you'll find a link to our guest's website. I'd give it to you on the air, but it's kind of long. And I figure just link to it, and that'll be fine. And I also suppose you could just put Mary's name into your browser, and you'd find her, Mary Capello, two P's and two L's. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. I was wondering, as I was reading your grandfather's, the first letter that you've included in the book from him, beautiful letter, and then in reading, on the next page after your letter in his workbook or his notebook, or in his collection of papers, that he did that thing with the listing English words, then their Italian counterparts.
Yes.
And I was wondering, could there be a culture, a people, without the word awkward?
Could there be?
Yeah. And what would it be to be without awkwardness?
I'm really not sure that there could be a culture in which this word doesn't figure. And the reason I think this is that because of what I said earlier about the ways in which it ramifies into so many different areas of human experience, from the most fundamental, at the basis of our being, the gap between being granted life, we're alive, all of us, and yet do we know how to live? We have bodies. Do we understand the way our bodies work? Do we feel embodied? What would that mean? There's always, it seems to me, a gap at work, at the most basic level of human existence. Any culture is going to have as part of its organizing principle of the senses, if you will, a language for directionality. One of the fascinating things to me about awkwardness is that literally it has to do with direction. it hails from, its etymology is turned backward or in the wrong direction, backhanded, left-handed even. And, of course, it's a relative of forward and backward. And contemplating the relationship between awkward and our language for directionality led me to think about the ways in which the eyes in our culture, you know, get to have, they get to be the prime sense that we follow. We presume that, you know, we're always wanting to move forward, but what if we wanted to move awkward? There might be a reason to do that. We presume that forward and backward are opposed. I do a lot of thinking about that in the book. So I guess I want to say that I don't know that there could be a culture in which there wasn't a word for awkward, but it's a wonderful question. It's a wonderful question.
I wonder when in the course of living one becomes aware of awkwardness, at what age?
Oh, that's a great question, yes. I like to think that children can't be awkward in the way that adults can be, because awkwardness does seem to require a degree of self-consciousness. And, you know, it seems as though the older one gets, the more replete the ego becomes, the more of a sense of the gaze of another person. It's interesting to me that awkwardness is something that maybe animals don't experience, nor is it really a human emotion, but it is a state of mind. And so this question about, that you've asked about when does it occur, I think that, children don't seem to have quite as acute access to it as adults. At the same time that if a child is precocious, we make them awkward because we don't, it suggests that our calling certain children who exceed their boundaries precocious implies that we don't expect children to exceed boundaries. We don't expect children to exceed ourselves. We don't expect children to exceed the developmental model, like a grid that we place upon human development. But of course, children at their very best do exceed these things all the time. And when they do that, there's an awkwardness about it. Not implicitly, but because they're having to work against the culture's insistence that they be a certain way as a child. And so it's sort of interesting that on the one hand we could say, well, maybe awkwardness is something that one becomes more aware of as one gets older because it's relative to self-consciousness. At the same time that children, of course, are made to experience all forms of awkwardness when they probably shouldn't be, when they exceed our expectations.
Let's take a call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I had an interesting kind of story to tell about my daughter, who has just turned 13, which is perhaps the quintessential age of awkward feeling, but she has just started using this expression that I thought was really funny. She shares a birthday with one of my good friends, and my good friend was over at the house, and we were all kind of just standing in the kitchen, and there became kind of a lull in the conversation. We were all kind of standing close together, and my daughter looked up at me with kind of a sideways glance and said, "Awkward." And I thought it was so funny. I said, "What do you mean?" And she, and because my friend and I have known each other for so long, we could stand there in silence for quite some time and not feel weird. But I thought it was funny that my daughter, you know, it's the first time I remember her ever like acknowledging how she felt, you know, in that kind of social situation. And she then later told me that that's something now that she says, you know, in certain situations in her social circle. And so it was kind of this. And before, she's a very kind of laid-back kid, and for her to, I think it became the point at which she realized this sense of feeling awkward in such a situation. So, anyway, I thought I'd just share that.
Thanks for the call. You want to
Sure, I could say something about that. First of all, that this word does seem to be gaining a currency among today's adolescents. I don't think I've started the trend with my book. But maybe I'm in touch with a trend that I didn't know was apparent. And I think that, yes, I've heard this from a number of people, that preteens and teens are calling things awkward. They're using the word awkward in the way that, it's not exactly like cool. I'm afraid it might function sometimes in the way that they use the word gay. Something is sort of off, and they, homophobically, unfortunately, will say, "Hell gay." Of course, the word awkward also means perverse. That is one of its synonyms. But it's fascinating to me that this word is creeping in. I wonder if it means that we can attribute to our young people more of a cognizance of what's important for the current moment than we ourselves are aware of. Being aware of awkward silences, that's a subject unto itself, how silence operates, whether we let it exist when we can't let it exist. In a radio interview,
you can't have any
dead air space. It's called, dead air space, I suppose. It would sort of be like insisting on stopping while you're driving down a highway.
Yeah.
What that means is that, of course, there's certain things that are going to be able to be enunciated because of this medium and other things that aren't. So I guess I would say to the young people who are using the word awkward, I want to learn from them how it's figuring for them. And at the same time, I want to hope that it means that awkwardness is something that they're willing to keep open and alive, to acknowledge, and not therefore, in acknowledging it, shut it down or shut its possibilities off.
Let's take another call.
Thank you to the caller for that telling episode.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone on line 2. Hello.
Hi. I'm driving in the back country, so I might lose you. But I tuned in a little late, and I heard you mentioned something about a chapter in your book on solitude, awkwardness and solitude.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, I was thinking that I'm a teacher and I'm also a poet, and yet when I spend like several days at home without talking to anyone or seeing anyone, and then I do see someone, I'm very awkward in my speech. It's very hard for me to communicate sometimes. But what happens as I talk to people during that kind of awkward phase is that I start hearing language in a different way. I start hearing a rhythm in speech patterns, and I start picking up more on nuances of body language or just how the words sound and how they're placed together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually makes me even a little bit more insightful in terms of how people may be feeling as they speak, even though I myself might have a hard time responding more quickly or as easily as I would when I'm more in daily contact with people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if that's what it is, how you talk about awkwardness and solitude.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, nice question.
Yes. I think about it in a number of different ways in the book. Leonardo Sciascia, a Sicilian writer, talks about people fragmenting us. People take us away from ourselves. And he talks about this idea of un solo uomo, the solitary man, the person who needs to have solitude in order to recollect himself. In a way, in order to fully be and to complete himself. Sciascia isn't opposed to sociality by any means. I mean, we can't live without other people, certainly. And in a way, we're never entirely, utterly alone, I suppose. But yes, I absolutely hear what you're saying insofar as solitude is requisite in a way to being in concert with other people. One needs to be alone in order to re-enter the world of discourse and hopefully hear it differently as a result of being alone. Solitude figures in, I'm thinking of two ways in the book that I might mention. One, in the novel of Henry James, The Awkward Age. It's a perfectly unreadable novel, and for that reason, I love it. And as I was reading it, I was trying to find its pleasure because I was resisting the idea that its pleasure might be found in its resisting me. And so I was trying to hunt down passages where pleasure seemed replete. And the passage that I decided was rife with the most pleasure was a passage in which one of the central characters is able to experience, without terror, the exquisite right that is that of every human being, and that is her existential solitude. That's one place in which solitude figures in my account of awkwardness. Another place that's coming to mind is an episode that appears very late in the book, where I'm thinking about precociousness and what it means to try to learn things on one's own. And I recount an episode from my past that, in trying to recall it, it seemed extraordinarily frightening because it was it had a sort of out of boundness about it. It was an episode in which, as a child, I dissected a frog without supervision in the basement of my family's working class domicile. And, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, certainly. But what drew me to do this? Why did I want to do this? The curiosity I had, my brothers were learning how to do this. They were older than I was, and they somehow had had brought a dissecting kit into the house. And there was this very bizarre little shop in the town where I grew up that featured among its many items specimens that a person could dissect. And, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was left with the sense that I violated this organism. In spite of the fact that it was no longer alive, of course, there was something sort of hideous about not knowing what one is doing. And at this moment in the book, I'm trying to understand, though, the importance of delving in such ways without the benefit of an instructor, and trying to understand what it was I was wanting to learn, but that might have been out of reach, and that perhaps I needed to pursue that curiosity alone somehow. I want to see if I can find that passage.
Yeah, it comes very late in the book.
Yes.
Near the end.
Please,
if I can. Page 161. Page 161. Let's keep going. 160. Oh, here it is. Page 164. Gargantuan. Is that it?
Page 160. That may be the section on.
I know.
This is. I can read this section if you don't mind. It's brief.
Okay.
This is a fun section because this is a section that describes what happens when you're at a dinner party and the person uses overly large dinnerware. My fork is heavy. Let's see. I'm eating dinner at a friend's house who uses oversized dinnerware. My fork is heavy and better suited to a weekend project involving large metal parts and hinges, maybe even a soldering mask in the garage, than the application of delicate food to a taste bud. Looking down into the immense girth of my plate makes me dizzy. A piece of spinach seems to swirl there at the center of an ever-contracting vortex. Large dinnerware makes me feel awkward.
Mm.
Not because it fails to suit my compact frame, but for the way it denies that food will enter my gullet and my bloodstream, that food will produce narratives, and gas maybe too, and stir memory, relax or stimulate me, fatten or sate, or move me to want more, to have an appetite. Large dinnerware introduces formality into rooms where intimacy should rule. I feel in such situations that my host is trying to shield me from my food, making it unnecessarily hard for me to have it.
Hmm. I'm going to go home and look at the silverware tonight. Yeah, that's fun. I'm sorry I couldn't find that other passage.
I can find it. I'll keep looking.
But we don't have a whole lot of time left.
My editor always reminds me that there's an index to this book, and that I should use it.
You know, maybe what we could talk about here a little bit is how awkwardness or the fear of it helps us to negotiate our relationships with one another.
Mm-hmm. Helps us. How awkwardness or the fear of it helps us to negotiate relationships with one another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feeling out where we are in terms of our personal space and what we can mm-hmm. talk about with one another. And as that one caller mentioned, you know, who I can be quiet with.
Yeah.
Not say anything. There are people on the telephone I can talk to mm-hmm. who we can just stop talking mm-hmm. and be silent mm-hmm. for a while, even though that's a medium where it's all about sound.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it is sort of fascinating how media orients us in relation to one another, either to be silent or to be noisy, or, you know, even thinking, to get back to that idea of what the interviewee wears for the...
for a radio interview.
For the radio interview. I mean, it has to do with space and embodiment and the relationship between space and embodiment and how we can think, how we think, and how we might converse with one another. I really didn't want to be wearing sweatpants, you know. this is a serious conversation we're having, and there's a degree of decorum and formality that's of the essence, and it's fascinating to me. I also originally planned to be sitting at my dining room table where I think about the way in which food and talking and thinking come together. And just before setting up to talk to you, I realized I really couldn't be at the dining room table. This conversation required that I be in my study at my desk. These are interesting things to note, aren't they, then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting choices. And, you know, and here we get back to the idea of consciousness and self-consciousness, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. The Frog, page 214, okay. 217.
It has to. I can give you 2 minutes.
2 minutes. The very, very, very last sentence of it.
Okay.
I wonder if I felt as a little girl that this thing that I was doing to the frog in so many untold ways had been done to me, or if, unmotivated by harm or by revenge, I simply was passionate to know more about the awkward ways anybody is poised at thresholds without the elasticity required to cross them, the ways anybody is required to stretch toward and beyond its own edges, to grow resignedly, unknowingly, Gumby-like, to be poked, prodded, examined, kept in place or released, hugged and slapped, stroked and jarred, rattled sometimes by the voice and hands of other beings, and sometimes simply because of physics, untoward propulsions, or the tendency of sharp or cold metal to accompany the swings in the playground that enabled one to fly.
Very nice. What a wonderful place to end. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Mary Capello has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. She's a professor of English at the University of Rhode Island. She's a poet, essayist, and critic. She is the author of Awkward, A Detour. The book is published by the Bellevue Literary Press.